Welcome to Seeing the Full Picture, a podcast about systems thinking for health systems. This is a special podcast series from the Alliance for Health Policy and Systems Research. It was developed with the George Institute for Global Health.
Episode 3 of our series is about the science and art of systems thinking in health. In this episode, we consider how systems thinking tools, methods, and approaches have been used in health policy and systems research, and how systems thinking is both an art and a science. We'll be speaking with two experts with experience in applying systems thinking in a variety of contexts. We'll ask them about what represents rigor in health system science, how health is actually catching up in applying systems thinking methods as compared to other fields, and also learn from them about real-world examples using different tools and methods. I'm Devaki Nambiar, and I'm a health policy and systems researcher working at the George Institute based out of Delhi in India.
Hi, my name's Stephen Jan. I'm co-director of health system science at the George Institute for Global Health in Australia, and I'm also a health economist by training. Before we start this episode, my co-host Devaki and I will just reflect on a few key aspects.
What I got from the discussion was that in many ways, it's non-negotiable, that it is important to think broadly and to think about some of the implications of what you're doing on wider systems, on wider populations, and the adverse consequences of your action.
I noticed almost a kind of impatience, like, let's get on with applying this. We know it's useful. We need to apply it a lot more. Yes, there are questions of rigor and whatever else, but one of the core principles of systems thinking, in effect, is learning by doing. It gives the opportunity for people on the ground to also apply that thinking and be part of that process with you, because it invites that complexity, right? And it doesn't necessarily separate out an academic expert from the context in which they are operating. So in order to do that kind of work, you, in fact, perhaps are becoming more relevant in the context in which you are working and are more mindful of it. And I think he's also wondering why aren't more of us doing this? We need to be doing this. It's, you know, it's an ethical imperative.
Maybe we are, but we don't actually think we are, because we're trained to think that that's not the right way of going about things. And we automatically try to see ourselves as, you know, that linear reductionist scientist who's really trying to filter out all that information. But faced with reality, sometimes these issues can't be avoided.
That was another favorite part of mine in this podcast, was the positionality of the researcher that both Carl and Kara got into somewhat, and how much that is part of the art, the science, the method of systems thinking as well.
Thanks for joining us, wherever you are in the world, to hear about systems thinking. With us today, we've got two very distinguished guests. First is Professor Carl Blanchet, Director of the Geneva Center for Humanitarian Studies and Professor at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Geneva. Currently, he's working on several studies, including one on resilience of health systems during conflicts and disease outbreaks. The second guest is Dr. Kara Dursky. She's affiliated with the World Health Organization and the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and has significant experience in public health strategy, outbreak response, and systems strengthening activities. Hi, Kara and Carl. Welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us today, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So just a very quick adding to that preamble, taking a multidisciplinary approach to this episode, we'll consider how systems thinking tools, methods, and approaches have been used in business, organizational issues, in health policy and systems research, and how systems thinking is both art and science.
Thanks, Stephen. And I think I'll get straight into it. Stephen ended up by talking about how systems thinking is both an art and a science. And I was wondering, in the context in which each of you works, what has been your experience of that, the art part and the science part of systems thinking?
Sure, I can answer this first. And I think it's a really interesting question. And it reminds me of a popular TED Talk a few years ago discussing wicked problems and making toast. I know some people are aware of this. And asking people to draw the process they use to make toast. And, you know, it seems like a very simple question. But if you ask different people with different upbringings to draw the process from start to finish on how they actually make toast, the answer turns out to be very different. And I think this example really highlights how systems thinking is an art, but it's also a science with very defined methods. And systems are inherently complex and with many interrelated and interconnected parts in order to address the challenges. With this level of complexity, we need rigor and the ability to be reproducible. But also, there's an art form to it. It needs to be feasible. It needs to be adaptable to the messiness involved when you approach a complex problem.
That's very interesting, I think, Kara. So I just, what is quite funny is that in this kind of world, that the few words like messy, fuzzy models, and that's very interesting. And then to the point that 7-8 years ago, when we started to think about system thinking and complexity in public health, I remember in London, mm-hmm. many of my colleagues use that as a very good excuse not to be able to answer the research questions. He said, no, the world is far too complex. We can't answer this question, and so on. So a misunderstanding of what system thinking is about, or complexity. And they love these kind of words like chaos, messy, and fuzzy. And suddenly we were in a world of art and improvisation, and suddenly science had disappeared. And I think it's a very interesting misunderstanding or misinterpretation of what system thinking is about.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Could I just ask a clarification question in relation to that? I sort of consider myself a bit of a scientist, and I can see how I can equip myself to develop that aspect of my professional capabilities. But you're saying now that part of the work that I need to do as a system scientist is also art. So how do I basically acquire the capabilities to master that aspect of system science?
So what is very interesting, and I think a few years back with because there was this kind of trend in public health or global health not to really understand how we translate all these kind of complex concept and system thinking complex into science. So we published a book to try to explain not only how we do system thinking research, but as well what kind of application we can have. So we published a book on applied system thinking research methodologies, where we listed 11 methods we could use. And the idea was very much about how actually we can inject a few rigorous methods and use that in order for people like policymakers, hospital managers. They are going to make decisions, but they're going to make decisions based on evidence. And this evidence will come from systems thinking research. So the art part, which is all about adaptability, I like Kara's definition of it, which is about how to make sure that we can adapt to a context, that actually every piece of information is going to be put back into a context so we can make the right decision. But the first part, which is about science and evidence, this can be done with a lot of very good, rigorous methods.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I was actually going to highlight that this is a fantastic book, and I think is a very easy way to understand some of the methods that, you know, can sometimes seem complex if you're just learning about them for the first time. It breaks it down to a very easy to understand level with good examples. And just in terms of the art, I'd also like to add that I think some of it is the mindset of researchers and others that are embarking on doing this and trying to maintain that level of flexibility. And I guess what's called a growth mindset in realizing that what you expect might not actually be the reality and just being open to that.
Thank you. So Kara, again, that book is Applied Systems Thinking.
For health systems research. Right? Yep, it's a methodological handbook. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the kind of thing that'll come up in a Google search because it's really quite clear and hits the nail on the head. I wanted to push a little bit on the art and science dichotomy because it seems to suggest that perhaps there is less rigor in art. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. There's actually a lot of rigor in art. But perhaps what we are gesturing towards in that aspect of what we do is creativity, right? And Carl, as you were saying, you know, there is the piece about generating the evidence base and understanding the complexity of situations. And as you said in your TED talk, not that they are necessarily complicated, but that they are complex. And then there is the piece about the aspects of translation and even breaking ourselves out of our disciplinary silos that may require some creativity of thought that brings in the art side. Would you agree? Or how do you receive that?
I completely agree with that. And I think what is interesting in the Global House and Public House, we're very much behind in this, in the use of these kind of methods. If you look at ecology, environment studies, they have been using that for quite a long time, and urban studies. So we are quite behind. What we do not understand is, first of all, how to do research using these kind of methods. But secondly, as researchers, we have difficulty to translate the findings of our studies into easy to understand messages. I'll just give a quick example. I'm sure Kara has a few other examples. I'm working a lot on system dynamics models and causal loop diagrams these days. And then so you've got a beautiful visual diagram, a figure on your screen, and with a lot of dots and a lot of arrows and so on. And actually, you show that to a policymaker, know where the person is going to understand that. And he has no idea where you need to focus your eye on. The message is not clear, it's not straightforward. So one of the key challenges for us as researchers is to make sure that we can be very rigorous, but we're still failing to make sure that the results of these methods, the results of these studies, can be easily understood by people like who are going to use, who are going to make the decisions. So we need to go one step further now. I think it's very important.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. And another, I guess, aspect related to that I've noticed is the monitoring associated with it and making sure that there is this continuous monitoring and what some people call like progress checkups or scheduled reevaluations, since that is really important in order to strengthen these systems, you know, over time.
Yeah, I think you've touched on some really important issues around rigor and I think that's a real challenge in this area, because it seems to me that it's a new and evolving field and there's not necessarily a strong consensus about methodological approaches that one would take to address certain problems. And I just wonder whether we can sort of press you a bit on this issue of rigor. I mean, what constitutes rigor in system science? In other words, I suppose, how would you sort of classify what's good and what's bad practice in this sort of research? Perhaps highlight examples of where there might be good examples of good work as well as examples of work that isn't so good.
I think the methods are very well defined. They have been used and applied and tested in many, many fields outside global health and public health. I think the lack of rigor does not come from the methods. It really comes from the researchers who probably take a few shortcuts in really understanding or interpreting the results. I think it's, if you look at public health, for example, not many researchers actually take the time to get the right training, to really learn how to use these methods, making sure they use it to the right potential. I did quite a few studies using these kind of methods in health systems research, and the training is never ending. There are excellent softwares, excellent tools, but actually analyzing the data requires a lot of skills and competencies, and the softwares are not as easy as expected to use. So you really need to train yourself as a trainer. If you look at system dynamics and causal loop diagrams, unfortunately, then suddenly there's a gap in terms of training. I'm not really sure where we need to get this training. So I do think that all the public health institutions, I think they need to invest on courses and training now to make sure that the team is well trained, because making sure that the methods are used the right way and the analytical models we're going to use to look at the data is used to its full potential. That's very important.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic point on the investment of courses. It's a lot of these methodologies are, as you mentioned, Carl, really widely used in other industries like aviation, banking, military, operations, management. They're taught through MBA courses, engineering courses, as part of their core curriculum. And, you know, just a quick Google search and you'll find, you know, Harvard Business Review and other journals and magazines, you know, writing case studies on how these methodologies are implemented in these industries. So it would be great, I think, in public health if we're able to start incorporating these as part of the core curriculum.
I fully appreciate that the tools that you mentioned have been used, have a long history of use in other areas. And I suppose I come from a field which has a similar sort of history. So I'm trained as a health economist, and a lot of the tools that we use in health economics have come from other areas and have been applied to health economics. But one of the things that we often encounter when we're applying tools that have been used elsewhere in health is the idea that health is sometimes often different and often a bit more complex than many of the other areas that they've been applied. And some of the issues in health around information asymmetries, the fact that people probably don't behave rationally in relation to health that they may in other areas such as the commercial sphere. Is that an issue here in the application of systems tools to health? Are there specific issues in health that make it a little bit different and perhaps a little bit more difficult to apply?
I would say, you know, in my experience in working in an outbreak response, the challenges are very similar to challenges that are faced when these methodologies are applied in healthcare settings, which it has been done quite often in the emergency rooms, for example, and in aviation where there's really high costs associated with actions in the military as well. So I do think that there are unique challenges, which I think might take in part of that art side of the discussion and making sure there's different flexibilities. But I do also think it's still very relevant and important.
And I do think sometimes people use this kind of being specific in health. So can you imagine? So I work in public health, but as well, I work in public health in humanitarian crisis. So I've got two communities who claim their specificity, claiming that actually, no, you cannot apply that. It's impossible. You cannot translate that. But I completely agree with Cara. Actually, we are unique in terms of topic. We are unique in terms of the context where we work, but we are not unique in the way that other sectors have also been obliged to adapt and translate and be very flexible and innovative to make sure that the methods can be applied to their sector. So in a sense, it's we all have to do that. And these efforts really need to happen. What is very interesting, I think, is that I do think that public health has spent the last 10 years, or let's say the last 8 years, to try to define what complexity and system thinking is about. And we are bored with these kind of papers. Now is not time anymore to define what system thinking and complexity is about. It's very much about to try to translate these kind of methods in our field, in our domain, in our context. So we need to move forward now. Every time there's a new literature review, it's all about definition, concept, and so on. Now it has to be about a good debate about the rigor in this field, in health system research and system thinking research. So, and to do that, we need to generate more studies in the field, in a real life situation, where we're going to see the benefits of this kind of methods.
Great, thank you. The next bit is perhaps each of you could just give us an example of the use of systems tools in the research that you have done in the past, just to get an idea of how it actually gets applied to some of the problems that we've been discussing.
What I wanted to do in health system research, I was in Ghana, and I was trying to understand the sustainability of a cataract surgery program in Ghana, set up by implemented by the Red Cross during 10 years, and they had left. So I went back to the same hospitals and the same district, and I was trying to understand how the transformation of local health systems, and I was trying to find the right methods to do that. And of course, I like visual tools, so I really want to really demonstrate how and in for which properties of the health system, there had been changes. And I found at that time social network analysis had never been used in health system research before. And I thought that could be a very nice way. I mean, health systems are made of and by people, individuals. And Devaki said that at the very start, talked about the importance of decisions, the importance of evidence users. So what I try to do is to try to understand the relationship between all the actors of the system at the moment when the Red Cross were still working in the area, and come back 2 years later and to see how the relationship had changed and why, and looking at the quality of the relationship, and then trying to visualize how the new health system, local health system, looked like. And this is how I discovered, and this is how I read about complexity, system thinking. I read a lot of ecology papers, trying to understand the concept of resilience, concept of sustainability, and suddenly opened my mind and my eyes about how rich these kind of, this new domain of research could be, so fascinating, but as well so revealing on how we could understand the functioning of health systems.
Cara?
Yeah, I can talk about one of the methodologies that we use, which is process mapping. And I, along with colleagues at Ministries of Health, Centers for Disease Control, and various other organizations, implemented this process mapping at various time points during a yellow fever outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a monkeypox in Nigeria, and Ebola in Sierra Leone, to try to address the acute problems associated with overstretched surveillance and lab systems. And all three of the scenarios were very different in terms of the pathogen and the complexities surrounding the outbreak, but in some ways they were very similar. And we went through the mapping exercise in each of the countries and brought together a variety of different people. And after we went through the redesign process and designed fairly simple solutions, the laboratory testing system in Sierra Leone noticed accelerated lab testing times from 6 days to 24 hours. In the DRC, the time for suspected case notification reduced from 7 days to 3 days. And in Nigeria, key data reached the national level within 48 hours instead of 5 days. So they were pretty dramatic changes, with just doing, you know, a fairly simple process mapping and not taking too much time from staff during the acute phase of an outbreak. And I think it really showed that despite some of this chaos and the complexity associated with an outbreak, it is possible to implement a systems thinking methodology such as process mapping, and I'm sure many others as well could be tested to address some of the immediate response priorities, but also at the same time slowly start to strengthen components of a system.
That's fascinating, Cara. And I think it's one of the characteristics of system thinking researchers. They really want to have a direct effect on the environment where they work. So it's not only being an observer, it's more than that. It's making sure that the results can be directly applied by people on the ground and make direct effect on the performance or the quality of the system. And the car example is very illustrative of that.
Yeah, one thing I would just add to that is there are so many different types of systems thinking methodologies. And I do understand sometimes people get bogged down by the amount of choices. One thing that might be helpful is to try to choose a methodology that aligns or supports the problem in the context. So in a outbreak or a complex emergency, it might be more useful to choose a methodology that takes, you know, a short period of time, or it doesn't involve a huge number of staff, so that it can be more agile and adaptable, whereas other methodologies might be better placed to be doing a long-term system strengthening exercise.
You've sort of taken the words out of my mouth. I was actually just thinking about the whole piece that Carl was also saying about this being an applied method, right? So the application or the use of systems thinking in public health is applied. And because public health is an applied field, in that context, I think, and you've sort of invited some of this reflexivity about the context in which systems thinking is being applied. But I wanted to invite your reflection and have you tell us or talk through examples. So it's not really just a question of what method you choose, but how you choose it and sort of why, which has to do with the context, but also who you are in the situation. So I was wondering if you had examples of that part of sort of choosing from the toolkit, if you will, of systems thinking and what journeys you have been through in doing that.
The positioning or the position of the researcher is great. And that's probably the case of Kara when I listened to your experience. And there is one of the methods described by Lucy Gilson in very much where finally the researcher is completely emerged into his or her environment and working with clinicians, hospital managers, and policymakers. I think there's an idea of co-production as well, where we define what we're going to do, where we're going to study. We're going to define the research questions together to make sure that the answers are going to be very helpful directly into this environment. You can imagine a researcher surrounded by clinicians, hospital managers, policymakers, and discussing about what are we going to do it and who should I interview?
Right.
I was going to ask something related to that question, actually, to Kara, and just having a look at the paper that you wrote about process mapping and your experiences in Nigeria and a couple of the other countries. It does seem like in order to implement something like process mapping, you position the researcher almost as the conductor in this response. My question is, how do you get yourself into that situation in the first place? I mean, to me, it seems very rare that a researcher is ever sort of at the centerpiece, of this sort of response. So I know you work at WHO, and often you guys are invited into provided a high level role. But I'm just thinking from the point of view of a researcher, how do we embed ourselves into a system where that we are able to implement the sort of strategies that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would probably say, which I know many researchers do, is making sure they have strong collaborations with the Centers for Disease Control within the country they're operating, or the Ministry of Health, and also having a wide network of the partners that are involved in that. That I think for the systems work that I have done, making sure that there's a wide group of people involved, because the systems are so complex and do really involve a lot of different people's viewpoints and understanding of how things work or don't, will be incredibly helpful.
So Kara, I was wondering, in an emergency context, how does that work? I mean, it's a bit of a chicken and egg, right? Because I think what we've seen with the pandemic, for instance, is that research collaborations have become more embedded because researchers have been able to provide, in some cases, more useful information to ministry or agency partners within countries. But in other contexts, there's a sort of situation of disarray and sometimes even mistrust, where there is further alienation and you vitiate the possibility of trying to collaborate and do applied systems thinking. So what has been sort of your experience or your lessons, you and Carl, on leveraging those setups in an emergency or a fragile setting context?
What is happening more and more now is that people want to have real-time information on what they're doing, if they're doing the right thing, and if they're making the right decision. We have seen that during the Ebola outbreak very much, where there was a discrepancy between the researchers who positioned themselves as observers, and that was not good enough for the responders. There was a kind of frustration about the academics being somewhere in the ivory tower and not understanding the need to actually immediately improve the response. I do think that some of the tools and methods we are using could actually, and Kara is a very good illustration of that, can actually improve the response straight away. And there's more and more now need for that, specifically in our field, where we have a, a good sense that some of the key decisions we are going to make are going to have a huge impact on individuals, on populations. And so more and more, I mean, actors like WHO, but as well the International Humanitarian Organization, for example, they really request a different positioning of the researcher. So to go and to travel and to sit down next to them and provide them with some of the tools so that they can improve the performance or the rightness of decisions. And that's very important. System thinking has actually some very good interesting tools. Process mapping is one of them, but as well, doing a quick social network analysis to understand the environment, the actors, and the different types of powers, that's easy to do. It's not expensive. It's quite quick. And that's the kind of expectations people have, responders have, of the researchers.
Yeah, I think that's your last point is definitely something that I'm thinking about, that it's important, I think, when having some of these discussions and being involved in the response to make sure that the methodology is, you know, more adaptable, such as it being user-friendly, that it doesn't require significant training for everyone involved, and that it's collaborative so that it brings people together to solve a problem, which in many of these contexts, like outbreaks and health emergencies, a variety of different people from different sectors are all brought together for the first time and all see the challenges from a different perspective. And if you're able to have a methodology that is easy to implement while also allowing people to have one common view of the problem, you're able to really make impact.
I mean, we are currently discussing with the WHO Alliance on Health Policy and Systems Research on the possibility of creating a committee of practice on this kind of methods. And it's a beautiful push from the Alliance, is to say this committee of practice has to be composed of researchers, of course, but policymakers as well. It's very important now that the gap between research and decisions needs to be reduced. And to do that, we need to put all these people in the same room, even if it's virtual, and making sure that we understand each other about the needs, but as well, the vocabulary, the jargon is well understood, and the methods can be used in the right way at the right time. And that's exactly, I think, the trend where we're going to now, is making sure that all the research institutions are going to work very closely with policymakers and managers, making sure that what we can generate in terms of evidence and in terms of tools can directly be applied to their context and their setting.
I was just going to ask, I mean, the systems responses that you talk about, you know, do they differ in the emergency situations that you guys generally operate to the situation where we don't have an emergency response? So, I mean, the obvious difference will be the urgency and the time frames that we were working in. Does that make a difference in terms of how we operationalize a systems response?
I'm very glad to hear about Kara's studies. What I'm trying to do now is, I've worked in health system research, and what I did most of the time is to work in a more stable context. So I've used this kind of methods in Nepal. I've used this kind of in Ghana, in Cambodia, in Somaliland. And now what I'm trying to do now is to try to make a few methodological adaptations so that we can use that in contexts like Syria, Yemen, refugee camps, Cox Bazar, for outbreak, like Aska described, but as well to for emergency services in general. So I think in humanitarian crises, I would say, I mean, not only global health was a bit late, but in humanitarian crises, we are still very timid to use this kind of methods. I do think there's a lot of adaptations we need to make, making sure that we can be fast enough and rigorous enough in this kind of context to be useful. And that's a big challenge.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the challenges are different, but as we were discussing earlier, there are similar but different challenges in other industries where they also, you know, are needing to make sure that they're able to operationalize these methodologies and with strong enough rigor, and they are still able to, you know, the one that comes to top of my mind is aviation, when they're doing their simulations to make sure that any of their processes don't cause, you know, catastrophic failures. So they also are operating on very high stakes when they're doing some of these, using these methodologies in other areas. So I do think that we should be able to do that as well, and still maintain a high enough level of rigor, as Carl was saying, that we're still going to be useful, it'll be reproducible.
I had a follow-up related to, I think the piece that you're both saying about sort of demonstrating value and making, quite often what ends up happening is you're making the implicit explicit. And a lot of the types of research that we do are in the sort of problem diagnosis kind of space. They're not as much in the solution space, if you will. I was wondering, particularly in the context of emergencies, if you have examples of kind of identifying what ought to be done using applied systems thinking rather than what is the problem.
Yeah, so actually during this process mapping exercise I was describing earlier, we did identify what the problem is, but then had a session with everyone that is involved to generate solutions. Mm-hmm. Some of the solutions were complex and would take a long period of time to be able to actually implement in a way that's useful to the system. Some were very, very simple solutions, like having a stamp pad to stamp your documents before they move to the next, you know, the next person. And having the end users alongside the policymakers all together to try to understand the problems, but also to generate the solutions, I think was incredibly valuable and allowed us to be able to design or redesign some of these processes that had good outcomes.
Okay, just one last question before we sort of sign off. And it's about the current sort of pandemic. And I just wonder, as systems people, what have been your observations about the overall pandemic response? And maybe we start with Carl.
There was a Lancet editorial paper by Richard Horton, who talked about, we're not living in a pandemic, we are living in a syndemic, where he was trying to understand, we're trying to explain that actually every effect of the pandemic goes far beyond public health and the health of populations. It puts pressure on health system and health facilities. It has a huge effect on the economy, on social relationship, on creating maybe tensions between members of families and the different systems in place. I give an example. For example, the management of the pandemic in refugee camp has not been fantastic everywhere, and it has created a lot of frustration and tension within camps in Greece, for example. And this shows the limitation of our capacity to manage this kind of situation. What is very interesting during this pandemic or this syndemic is that suddenly that we realize that actually a starting point can have a ripple effect far beyond the sector where it started. And this is where system thinking is very helpful. Health system researchers can be helpful, but we need to put with us other people, people who can understand the education system, people can understand the political system and so on, and the economy, of course, the economist needs to be there. So suddenly we have teams of researchers from different disciplines working together, looking at one problem, but from different perspective and from different angles. And suddenly it makes all sense. And this is where actually all these system thinking methodologies will have a lot of value. This is how it should be done. This is not what was done. This is not what has been done. It's still the case now. So we haven't seen many multidisciplinary teams working together, unfortunately. And you can see that at the government level. You've got a lot of scientific committees, but they're made of clinicians, they're made of epidemiologists, sometimes social scientists, sometimes not everywhere, but actually it's still a narrow view of what needs to be done.
I completely agree. I think the pandemic highlights the importance of systems thinking methodologies and approaches to be done during all the phases of response, from the preparedness component to the response, as well as through the recovery phases. And as Carl was mentioning, it's, you know, we live in a very complex system where there's a variety of different sectors involved. And even from, despite these, you know, macro challenges, there's also very focused issues that could be streamlined and supported during this pandemic. Things such as, you know, streamlining the flow of information in surveillance systems, the maximizing the effectiveness of contact tracing systems, the optimization of current vaccination systems to roll out the COVID vaccines, which again will take many different people from different sectors to all come together to try to understand how best to enhance and improve the current systems. And, you know, I think a unique opportunity during a pandemic and during outbreaks in general is to harness this influx of funding to strengthen some of the systems, and that this could be valuable as long as it doesn't divert significant time away from the acute response operations. But systems thinking is all these different methodologies really could support long-term strengthening of systems during a lot of these acute emergencies.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, both of you. I really appreciate the insights that you've provided for us today, and look forward to chatting to you some other time soon.
I have so many follow-ups, but I don't think time allows that. But I do want to say, as a social scientist myself, I feel very grateful and validated that you both have endorsed the democratization of public health, including in emergency responses. So I'm very encouraged to hear that, and look forward to reading more of your work and learning from you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope this episode has inspired you to consider the relevance of systems thinking approaches in your work. Make sure you subscribe to Seeing the Full Picture so that you don't miss an episode. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.